Last week, a year after he'd written an op-ed for the New York Times critical of the harsh conditions endured by migrant workers building the new NYU campus in Abu Dhabi and other construction projects there, NYU professor Andrew Ross was barred from boarding a plane to the island emirate. And lawyer and journalist Sean O'Driscoll, the co-author of a major New York Times story on the same subject last May, was recently deported from the country. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to our show now. You're welcome here, even if you aren't in Abu Dhabi.
Thank you, Lenny.
Andrew, can you tell us what happened last week when you tried to board the plane to Abu Dhabi International Airport? What reason were you given for not being allowed to get on the plane?
Well, I was not allowed to board the plane after a phone call was made to the Abu Dhabi authorities, who said that I wasn't allowed to enter the country for security reasons. And I did ask for clarification of that.
But yeah, what do security reasons mean? You're a professor of social and cultural analysis at NYU, president of the NYU chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Doesn't sound like a radical to me.
Well, to tell the truth, Lenny, they couldn't have chosen a worse person to bar from entry, because NYU faculty and students are supposed to be afforded safe passage to the UAE because we have a very large and prominent high-profile campus there.
Does every faculty member and student who visits the NYU campus there have to be approved by the government of Abu Dhabi?
Not at all. Not at all. But we do have this peculiar situation now, which puts the UAE authorities more or less in the position of being able to judge which faculty can come in and which cannot.
Had you visited the UAE before?
I had, to do research on migrant labor conditions. And the time I was there before, I was followed by a car with tinted windows everywhere we went.
After you wrote that op-ed last year, did you get any feedback from the NYU administration?
Not directly, no. The administration doesn't have a particularly good relationship with its faculty. We don't have a lot of dialogue with the administration. But I do
you
know
think that's going to change with the change of administration?
We certainly do hope so. We certainly do hope so for all sorts of reasons.
Now, Sean, hadn't you been living in Abu Dhabi for some time before you were deported?
I was. I was living in Abu Dhabi for about 2 years, and then previous stint in Dubai for about 18 months. Yeah.
How did you wind up there? Did you go there as a journalist?
I went there as a journalist, yeah. I was always curious about the Middle East and wanted to see what it was like and kind of focused on labor issues while I was there.
You've written for The Guardian, The Independent, and the UK. Were those articles specifically about the working conditions for immigrant workers in the United Arab Emirates?
Yes, there were, but I always mixed up my names and used pseudonyms in the British papers. They always allow that. So in the Sunday Times, I was Dan Milligan, and The Independent, I was Tom South.
And why did you feel that was necessary?
Oh, because I was under a lot of surveillance. You know, I'd get up in the morning and there'd be a car waiting outside my apartment, and you know, they would follow me to work, they would follow me to the gas station. I was just constantly under scrutiny. So I felt if I used different fake names all the time, then they would never pin it down to one person.
Why do you think you were under scrutiny? Just because they saw you talking to the workers?
Yeah. Well, the big surveillance started after a Guardian investigation. There was a video with it. And even though they blurred me out, I think it was pretty obvious that some tall guy with an Irish accent was asking awkward questions. And then that's when they started coming around to my house and they started following me to work. And so
you are tall. You must have stood out like a sore thumb when you were there. But then you co-authored a story last May with Ariel Kaminer, and the Times refused to let you use a pen name. Why? Didn't they understand your problem?
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion about it, but they felt that it would be misleading to their readers if I used a fake name or a pseudonym, which the British papers didn't have a problem with. And I was hoping to use maybe an English version of Sean, which is John, which is on my birth certificate. And you know, there was a lot of back and forth at the Times, but they said no way. So that was that. I mean, I knew there was going to be trouble after that one, that's for sure.
How soon after the story came out with your real name attached did you have to deal with the authorities?
Oh, immediate. I mean, the day before, I was in a hotel in Dubai, and I was pacing up and down wondering, should I be doing this? And then I just fell asleep thinking about it, and then I woke up the next morning and the police were calling me. So it was you know, very, very immediate.
I don't remember seeing all that much in the American press about what's going on in the AE, the AE,
UAE,
UAE, right? It's easy for me to say Abu Dhabi, but is that just because it's seen mostly as a business story?
Well, I think, Lenny, the one exception to that, it is mostly a business story, but the one exception is in the case of this very zealous pursuit of cultural assets on the part of Abu Dhabi, which include trying to acquire NYU and the Guggenheim and the Louvre. All of these institutions with high-profile names have been lured to erect buildings and set up shop there. So there's been a lot of coverage of that. And we've been trying to draw attention to the conditions of the migrant workers, largely by putting pressure on these institutions.
Abu Dhabi is one of the world's largest producers of oil. It's home to important financial institutions such as the Abu Dhabi Securities Exchange, the Central Bank of the United Arab Emirates, and it's the corporate headquarters of many companies and numerous multinational corporations. Are they trying to expand their economy through tourism as well?
I think that's part of it, and they're on a massive nation-building program that does involve trying to buy this sort of cultural gloss of these institutions and these brands. The problem is you can't really have it both ways. If you're bringing in institutions that trade on academic freedom and free artistic expression, you can be clamping down on that at the same time.
Sean, are they doing this mostly in Sarayet Island?
Yeah, that's the big cultural center. It's worth $27 billion. So that's where you find NYU, Guggenheim, the Louvre, various British schools and so on. And that's
British schools as well?
Yeah, like Cranleigh. It's a very upscale
high school.
And yeah. Then some of the world's most famous architects.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you have Andrew, help me out here. We have
Frank Gehry, Norman Foster, Jean Nouvel, Zaha Hadid. Do you think that they're trying to show the world that Abu Dhabi is on the same level culturally as cities like New York and Paris?
Well, you could say our robber barons acquired roomfuls of European art at the turn of the 19th, 20th century in order to build up this nation's own cultural patrimony. And in some respects, Abu Dhabi's doing something no different. But the problem is,
I thought they were buying up apartments in London and New York. I didn't know that.
Well, that's actually more easy to do than buy up cultural assets that include scholars and intellectuals and artists, because these are the kinds of people that require, basic freedoms to do their work, to think and create and so on and so forth. So you really can't have it both ways. That's part of the big problem here.
My guests are Andrew Ross and Sean O'Driscoll. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Sean, why have NYU, the Louvre, the Guggenheim, and these other institutions agreed to build these projects in Abu Dhabi? I mean, in the case of the Louvre, this is the first branch to be built outside of France.
Yeah, there was several offers made to the Louvre to come to Abu Dhabi, and they said no, but then the price just went up and up and up until it solved all their budget problems, and they agreed to do it. But the problem there is that you have on an official level all these promises by the Louvre to their staff members and to their supporters that workers won't be hurt. But then, in the middle of the project, the workers went on strike, and then loads of them were rounded up and deported. So, and the same with NYU as well. You have this kind of talking to their supporters and trying to reassure them that all workers will be respected. But then on a different level, you see a totally different story.
What kind of money are we talking about here?
$500 million for the use of the name of the Louvre alone. I mean, that's transparent and public because the Louvre is a public institution, so you can go and view the contract online. We don't know about the other institutions, how much money traded hands in the case of Guggenheim or NYU, but certainly a lot.
Where do the workers who are constructing all of these new buildings come from?
Bangladesh, India, Pakistan.
South Asian countries,
yeah.
And how did they get these jobs in Abu Dhabi? Do the construction contractors go to Bangladesh and India and Pakistan to enlist workers?
Well, there are different supply routes. Some of them are at the level of local villages, recruiters in local villages. Sometimes the companies themselves, the construction companies in the Gulf, are involved in recruitment at the local level. But basically, they all come with a massive amount of recruitment debt on their backs when they arrive, on average about $2,000, which is a massive amount of money for people in their situation.
Is that what's part of what's been called the kafala system?
That's the kafala sponsorship system.
Is this something unique to the Arab world or specifically the Emirates?
You also see it in Qatar and Saudi and it's across the Gulf region.
How does it work?
Well, basically, workers are recruited by recruitment companies in their own countries, and then they are tied to the employer that they are sent to. Their passports are taken from them, and it's actually a criminal offense in the UAE and many of the Gulf countries for a worker to leave their employer. So actually, when you get onto the courts, you see cases. You may go up to a prison officer and say, what's he in for? And they'll say, oh, absconding. Absconding is actually a crime.
Do the employers and workers sign contracts specifying the rates of pay, the length of the workday, and other details?
Often the case you'll find a contract for pay in the recruiting countries. So they may go into an office in Islamabad or Dhaka and sign something, but of course that's worthless once they get there. They'll say, oh, that was with your recruiter, and then they have no other legal recourse.
And then the workers have to pay a recruitment fee in order to get these jobs. That sounds like a bribe to me.
Well, it's a form of – there are many labels for it, Lenny. Some people call it trafficking. Others call it debt bondage, bonded labor, or even forced labor. Regardless of the label, however, the key fact is that no one would work under the conditions they work under if they didn't have to pay off this massive debt. And the conditions,
but they're not aware that they're going to have to pay that off. They also have to pay.
Yeah.
They also have to pay for their transportation to Abu Dhabi.
There are all sorts of additional costs that kick in when they get to the Gulf that they haven't been told about. And the wages, typically, and certainly this is drawn from the testimony we've taken in interviews with the workers. Typically, the wages that are promised by the recruiters are not the wages they're paid when they get to Abu Dhabi.
How long does it take them to pay off the debt, or do they ever pay it off?
Well, you see, usually they pay up front to the recruitment company, and then they have to pay back their family and so on. So, I've interviewed workers who are working in NYU who had to mortgage the rice fields in Nepal, take that money, pay directly to the recruiter, and then they pay it back, to a moneylender or their family or whoever has given them the money.
Do we know how much they're told they're going to be paid and how much they're actually paid?
It really depends company to company, but typically they're told you'll make maybe 1,000 dirhams or 1,200 a month, and then they come and discover that they're making 750 or 800 and so on.
How does that compare with what they might have made back home?
That's a good question. We've done interviews around this, and the fact is if you invest a few years of your life into this kind of work life, you want to continue doing that after you've paid off the debt to make sure that you actually come in with something to show for it. So people stay much longer. And when you ask them, well, was it worth it? The psychology around that is kind of ambivalent because no one wants to admit or concede that they've taken 4 years out of their life for nothing.
So I'm assuming they also have to pay for housing and food and all sorts of other things.
Depending on the contractor, yes, there are food allowances and other fees that kick in. So it's a very difficult situation for them. And I have to say that most countries treat the migrant workers pretty badly. I mean, this country does.
The United States does?
Yeah.
And we used to have the company store, if you remember, 16 tons. This sounds to some degree like Tennessee Ernie Ford wrote a song about life in Abu Dhabi.
It is. But I would say that the Gulf states are in a class of their own because we're talking about 80 to 90% of the resident population is this massive army of a servant class that is available to do all sorts of tasks for a trifle.
So only 10% of the population is actually the people of Abu Dhabi?
Yeah, well, that's what makes the political situation so volatile for them, and why they really clamp down on any kind of labor agitation, because they're very afraid of all of this. They're very afraid that 90% of the people are not from there and don't have any particular loyalty to the country.
What about the tension that we've seen in other Muslim countries, the Sunni-Shiite tension? Does that apply here as well?
Oh, most definitely, yeah. There's been a lot of cancellation of visas for Shias, and a lot of Shias have been sent back because, again, it's this fear that there may be outside influence that will come into play.
But since they have so much money, this is one of the richest places in the world per capita, why are they doing this? Is this a form of racism?
It's not an issue of money, Lani. That's pretty clear. Emirati elites are awash in money. It's a question of power. The ability or the capacity to have this, as I said, a huge servant army at their disposal to do all of these tasks readily available with no rights and living in fear of deportation, that's a very powerful situation for elites to be in. It's a question of power and not money.
My guests are NYU Professor Andrew Ross and lawyer and journalist Sean O'Driscoll, both of whom are now barred from being in Abu Dhabi. We will take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about what life is like for the workers on these construction sites. Stay with us. And we are back with Sean O'Driscoll, a British journalist and lawyer, and NYU Professor Andrew Ross talking about being barred from the United Arab Emirates and Abu Dhabi in particular. And did you know each other there?
We met there, actually, because I was doing research that overlapped with what Sean knows. He was really the most knowledgeable journalist working on these issues. So we did meet there, yes. We were also surveilled and tracked and followed while we were there. Maybe Sean will talk about that.
Sean, you talk about being trailed by an unmarked car.
Yeah.
Did you do what they do in the movies?
I did.
Start doing zigzaggy things and making sharp turns?
I did. I mean, that's when I knew that I was being tracked electronically, because when Andrew was in the car, they were on top of us all the time. And I wanted to introduce him to some NYU workers, but the police flooded a mall where I was supposed to meet them. We had to cancel the meeting. But then they were on our case all night. So then I started reversing backwards up roads and over bridges and through roundabouts, but everywhere we went, they would manage to find us a few minutes later. Andrew was staying in Abu Dhabi, so we drove from Dubai to Abu Dhabi, which is about an hour and a half, and they stayed on our tail, and then they were waiting for me outside my apartment the next morning. So there was just no way to shake them off.
Are there other international journalists still working there?
Yes, there are. Yeah, there are people working for it, but maybe not as much into labor rights issues.
Well, you are an object lesson to them, aren't you?
Exactly, exactly.
What are the living conditions like for the workers? Didn't the government of Abu Dhabi build a very nice worker village to house the construction workers?
Well, that's a good question, because there are at least two or three showpiece labor camps now in Abu Dhabi. And one of them is on Saadiyat Island itself. It has a very finely manicured cricket pitch. And it's the facility that international visitors are taken to. It's sort of like a Potemkin village, if you like. It has a feel of a detention camp inside. I mean, regardless of the amenities, however, it's very socially isolated. There's a curfew. There's endless complaints about the food. And if you ask the workers who are forced to live there whether they would rather live there in the so-called ship-shaped camp or in some more informal accommodations in the city, they will always choose the city because of the community life, the access to informal markets.
So they can get their own apartments in the city?
They in principle, yes. It's not easy to do that, but in principle, yes. So the isolation of the official accommodation village is a huge problem for most of them.
And I gather most of them don't live in these worker villages.
Yeah, there's a lot of smaller informal camps and apartments and that kind of thing. So, you know, I would get up at 5:30 in the morning and just follow these buses because I didn't know where they lived, the ones that were on NYU and the big projects, and you would find these kind of really overcrowded apartments and smaller labor camps in the industrial area, this kind of thing.
What about the working conditions on the construction sites? Did they adhere to American safety standards?
I think it depends on the project. I think the safety record on NYU, for example, has been very, very good. I think that when British and American companies are involved, generally they tend to raise the safety standards, yeah.
What about the architects? Have they gotten involved in looking into these human rights abuses? I remember reading that Zaha Hadid said that something to the effect that this is not really her concern.
Right. I tried the same thing with John Novell on the Louvre. For The Guardian, you can see it on the video on the website where I would go up and ask him a few questions. But he clearly wasn't aware of these issues at all, and he didn't know that there was a strike among workers at the Louvre and they were deported and so on.
It's illegal to strike, isn't it?
Yeah, it's illegal, yeah. There's actually mandatory reporting of strikes, so if there's a strike at a company, then the company must tell the police.
And then the workers are automatically deported?
Yeah.
And then what happens to their contracts? Do they still owe money?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I mean, that was the big problem at, you know, BK Golf, which was one of the main contractors on NYU, where the company said that, you know, they had to report the strike, and then the police came in riot gear, you know, wearing balaclavas, kicked the doors down door to door, dragged the workers out, beat them down the stairs, took a busload of them off to prison. They weren't allowed access to the prison mosque. They weren't allowed to mix with other prisoners, and then they were sent home. And when I talk to them now, you know, I keep in touch with them, and their number one complaint is that they still have to pay their recruitment fees.
It gets pretty hot in Abu Dhabi, 120 degrees or so in midday. Did they work? How many hours did they work, and do they have to work through the heat?
Well, they're not supposed to work when the temperature hits 50 degrees Celsius. And there is
what is that?
There's a joke. Fahrenheit? There's a joke that the temperature never gets that high in the UAE. But I would like to say something about the safety conditions question you asked earlier, because it relates to this, Lenny. There aren't that many recorded deaths on site, at least the big projects that we're talking about. There was only one death incurred in the course of the NYU construction. But what happens off-site is much more perilous. The extreme vulnerability, the exertions from overwork and working in that kind of heat result in deaths.
And in your op-ed piece, you wrote that almost 1,000 workers have died in Qatar while building the infrastructure for the 2022 World Cup.
That's right. And we have
Are these mostly from construction accidents?
Yes. Well, they're from heart attacks officially, and we were very suspicious of this because, you know, 1,000 people die of heart attacks. It's something that generates suspicion, but in many cases it's actually true.
Because of the demands
of the work and the heat, and there are also high levels of suicide from the intense pressure of dealing with the fiscal pressure of paying off this debt and being able to send money home. Some of my colleagues from the Gulf Labor Coalition, which is the group of artists and writers that I work with in putting pressure on the Guggenheim Museum, were in India in December, and they took testimony about the coffins that arrive daily at Hyderabad Airport from the Gulf. And these are workers who have died from suicide or overwork every day.
Were you able to interview some of these workers? Are they willing to speak with you, or are they afraid?
It really depends on the company. Sometimes it takes a bit of effort because, let's say, for example, in BK Golf, where there was police violence and so on, some of the workers were very afraid, and you had to come back 2 or 3 times to get them to talk. But other companies, they're more than willing to talk.
Were you able to visit their living quarters?
Yes.
The work sites?
Not the work sites. But generally, I would go down. I mean, if I wanted to interview people at NYU, I would just go down to the car park and just wait for buses to come out and just follow them and see where to go and then talk to them at the labor camp. Some labor camps are easier than others. When there's no security, it was easier.
Didn't representatives of the Human Rights Watch also visit some of these sites and issue a report?
They did.
What
and
did
they've
they
also
say?
Been barred from entry. their reports, they've been reporting in this for 12, 13, 14 years, a series of reports that have been quite scathing. And they are equally focused on the directors or the administrators of the museums and NYU presidency. They've now been barred from entry. Increasingly, there are very few people now who have access to the labor camp. So it's very important. For example, for myself, I was planning to go last week during my spring break to do my research. I'm a labor researcher to collect testimony from workers. It's not that difficult to locate workers in the informal labor camps and talk to them.
Well, if they represent 80% of the population, exactly. It's pretty much everybody who doesn't look wealthy.
Right. But the official labor monitors who are employed by NYU and by the museums have not been doing a very good job of accessing those workers.
There's also a group called Gulf Labor. Are they also barred?
Well, that's a group that I was traveling to work with. And we're very active in putting pressure on the Guggenheim and mostly focused on the museums. There's a limit to who you can bar. I mean, if you're going to be barring NYU faculty, if you're going to be barring artists who are associated with the museums, there's a point at which the directors and the presidents have to say enough is enough.
Do you have any sense of what the museums plan to put into these facilities? Is the Louvre going to have some of its masterpieces moved over there, the Guggenheim as well?
Yeah, well, every so often there's a cultural center called Manarat al-Sadiat, and they display what's going to be in the Louvre. So they have a lot of work that are brought in from Europe. And interesting enough, they've brought in so much stuff that they are now lending it out to other museums. So for example, the Georges Pompidou Center has some of the artwork that has been bought for the Louvre Abu Dhabi.
Is the NYU campus now finished?
It is finished. But that's not to say there isn't a large operational workforce that's needed to maintain it. And in addition, I feel, and many of my colleagues at NYU feel, that we have responsibilities there now as a research university to generate some solutions.
How many students are enrolled there? Are they coming from this country or are they from the Emirates?
They're from all over the world. They get a free ride there because everything is bankrolled by the Abu Dhabi government.
So the tuition is subsidized?
It's zero. Tuition is zero. NYU over here is one of the highest rates on average of student debt in the country on graduation. So there's quite a disparity between the student population there and the one here.
What about adhering to the laws and cultural rules of a place like Abu Dhabi, especially in terms of social behavior? Or do people women have to wear headscarves?
They don't have to wear headscarves. No, I think generally these kind of laws apply more to migrant workers than they do to Westerners. You know, I mean, obviously Westerners have to observe. Let's say for in Ramadan when Muslims are fasting, you can be arrested for drinking water on the street. And every year there is the occasional arrest like that. But generally, sex outside marriage, those kind of things. When you go down to the courts, you'll see lines of maids from India and Bangladesh. They tend to be the ones on the receiving end of that. And that also goes for, let's say, homosexuality is banned. You don't see many Westerns in the courts. You see lots of South Asians.
But when we're talking about a place like NYU's campus, are we talking about a place that is kind of a protected zone where academic freedom is respected?
It's supposed to be. And that is why, you know, the barring of entry to me is such a huge problem for the institution. It leaves a very large question mark over the enterprise there. And to date, the president of NYU has had nothing to say about the incident. In fact, the incoming president has had more to say about it than the incumbent president.
What about the people who are teaching there? Are we hearing from them and the students? Are they aware or concerned about the situation?
I think they probably are. There's already a fairly high level of self-censorship that operates in that kind of environment. They're told that there are only two things that are off limits, criticism of the royal family and criticism of Islam. But obviously there are many other areas of expression that come very close to the bone, labor conditions being one of them. democracy being another.
Well, I'd imagine democracy is going to be an issue when NYU finally completes its Shanghai campus, which is currently under construction.
Shanghai is opened.
Oh, it is?
It is open for business. And that's a whole other story, which hasn't been properly aired, I think, and hasn't been properly scrutinized, has been kept to the side, as it were, largely because of all the scrutinies being in Abu Dhabi.
And when your article appeared in the New York Times, did NYU have any response at all?
Not to me.
They write to the Times in defense of themselves?
Not that I'm aware. I mean, not officially or publicly.
Sean, they did write unofficially to the New York Times, because I was quoted about Andrew's case in the New York Times, but then they had a few things to say about that, that's for sure.
Do you know if either of you will be able to go back to the UAE at some point, or are you banned for life?
I was just given deportation papers, and they just said reason for deportation, security. It never said, you know, that I'd be allowed back in again, so I presume it's for life, yeah.
And security, they didn't explain what security was.
No. I was just going through immigration, and it just flashed up on the computer, and then I was taken to investigations room, and that was it.
I think the same category exists in when the U.S. bars entry to a whole range of personages, too. A lot of states just cite security reasons. I would certainly like to go back and continue my work. And I've called on the president of my university to clarify the situation as soon as he can. Otherwise,
they could also put you on the faculty of that campus, couldn't they? Wouldn't that be a way to protect you? Well,
my colleagues, I mean, we come and go all the time. We're supposed to come and go all the time. Some of my colleagues teach over there.
My thanks to both of you for being on our show, Andrew Ross and Sean O'Driscoll. It's been an eye-opening conversation, and it's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you, Lana.
Thank you.